Coming up on this week's episode of TechSnap, how our very own Alan saved PayPal a heck of a lot of embarrassment and some cash, details on FreeBSD Project's compromise, and the latest advances in password hashing, plus a big batch of your questions, our answers, and an iOS 6 bug that could be costing you some money. All that and a heck of a lot more in this week's episode of TechSnap. Hi, everyone, and welcome to TechSnap. This is episode 85 of Jupiter Broadcasting's weekly Systems Network and Administration podcast. We recorded this episode live on November 21st, 2012. This episode is brought to you by our fine sponsor, GoDaddy.com, and I'll tell you more about them as the show goes on. And the live stream is powered by the incredible ScaleEngine.com. My name is Chris, and joining us every single week is our host, the admin, the professor, and the tech, Alan Jude. Hey there, Alan.
Hey, Chris, everybody. Thanks for watching.
Hey, man, welcome to episode 85, and thank you for doing it a day early this week so that way I can make room for Thanksgiving.
Silly American holidays.
I know. I think we should do it earlier like you guys do to give it more space between Christmas.
Yep.
You know, spread out
also,
those family
visits.
Also,
nicer weather is always nice.
Yeah, that's true, too. Now, and plus it kind of makes more sense with the seasonal stuff. By the way, Before we get going, I know we have a huge show. In fact, I was looking over the show. It's so big I had to print certain aspects of our show out just to keep track of it. I'm not kidding you. And I'm looking at it. Alan, I think you're doing 70, 75 show in a 35 show zone. So we might get a ticket. It's such a big show. It's a huge show this week. But before we get to all of that, you got a new toy, and I thought it'd be kind of fun to show it off at the top of the show.
Some TechSnap viewer heard the other day, a couple weeks ago, when I was saying that someone asked in the chat room if I had, played with a Raspberry Pi yet. And I was like, no, I wasn't able to get one. Every time I looked at getting one, they were all sold out or whatever. And so he was like, well, I bought a revision 1 and then they came out with revision 2 and I bought that. So I don't really need the revision 1 version. And
aww.
So he sent that over to me.
So he sent you his Raspberry Pi. That's so nice of
him. Yes. And it's like not even opened yet. It's like brand new.
So are you going to try putting like BSD on there or something?
Yes. When I was at MeetBSD in California, there was a bunch of talk about the work that had gone into getting FreeBSD to run on this. And so I was like, well, I can, help out with some bug testing or whatever, and I can try it out.
Yeah, dude, cool.
And, you got your little HDMI port and slow Ethernet and some USB ports and your audio out, so should be all good.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see what you come up with. Now,
yes.
All right, well, why don't we get into our news stories, because we have a lot of big news to get to. And in fact, this first story, eventually throughout it, you'll find out that Alan actually knows a little bit about the background to this one. In fact, he's been sitting on some information for many, many weeks now at the request of PayPal, so he's going to give us some background into this. But Alan, what is the first story this week?
Okay, so a researcher found some flaws in PayPal that may expose sensitive data, and he also found some flaws in their bug bounty program when he tried to report the first set of flaws that he found.
Double whammy.
Yeah. So PayPal has a bug bounty program they started on June 21st of 2012. And basically, it says that if you follow the rules of their bug bounty program and do responsible disclosure to them, they won't come after you for attempting to break into PayPal. So, basically, the rules are fairly simple. It's like, do this, do that. Never continue if you get to the point where you might be accessing individual people's personal data. Right? So you can try, cross-site scripting injection and doing SQL injections and stuff against PayPal.
Mm-hmm.
If you follow the rules, they won't, try to sue you or have you arrested.
Assuming you tell them about it.
Yeah. Assuming that if you find something, you tell them about it. And that you never actually access anybody's information if you do find an exploit.
Okay.
So a couple days after it came out, about a week after it came out, a security researcher saw the story about PayPal's new bug bounty program and decided to see if he could find any bugs to make some money. Because, PayPal's offering fairly... they don't disclose what the minimum and maximum payments are, but they do offer fairly large amounts of money as far as I know.
Okay.
So he decided to take a look at PayPal and see what he could do. So like anybody who has some experience with this, he started his quest by doing a search on Shodan, which is a search engine we've talked about a couple of times with regards to like some SCADA systems.
Right.
And,
we talked about just last week, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And so basically, it's a search engine that contains technical details about websites and stuff. So, you know, you could find the version string of the web server or what it says on a page or things like that. So we went there and searched for admin and PayPal and basically ended up finding a version of the PayPal admin tool on a staging server, which is a server PayPal uses to test a new version of PayPal before they deploy it to their live website.
Okay.
So we found a number of publicly accessible staging servers that have names like stage2mb106.paypal.com or, you know, stage4mobile19.paypal.com and so on. So when he found those, you know, he basically gets presented with a non-standard login page for this admin tool. And he starts by just trying to do authentication bypass with SQL injection. So he looks at how it normally submits the username and password to be checked and just, you know, inject some SQL into the end of some of the fields to try to trick the admin tool into letting him in, even though he doesn't have the right username and password, based on using the SQL injection.
Hmm.
So he tried some random usernames, and eventually he tried one, L. Smith, and he got an error page back saying he didn't have access to whatever. But on the corner of the screen, in the link, there's details and images. But on the one part of the screen, there's this message that says, "You are logged in as Lori Smith." So, you know, the random username L. Smith has now been expanded to a real username, so you kind of know that there's a real account with that name at PayPal.
Wow.
So then he did some more testing and found that J. Smith was Janine Smith. Right? So there's more than one person whose data is like this, right? It's going on from there. So he wasn't sure what else you could do with this admin area because he couldn't actually get logged into it so far. But he decided to Google about it a little bit. So he looked at like the titles of the pages.
Sure.
And started Googling. And after a little bit, he actually found some PDF files from court cases that basically when there was a court case that involved a PayPal account, PayPal, through their admin tool, prints out this couple of page PDF that details everything that happened in an account. So it's got like the owner's name and how much money was in it and how much transactions they've done in the last 3 months and, you know, all the transactions on, so that when there's a court case about a PayPal account, it's all the information you would need without having to, you know, all the stuff the court would need to prove or disprove something happened with a PayPal account. And every one of those has a little, you know, URL that it was printed from at the bottom, and they're all admin.paypal.com. So if he's looking at admin.stagingsomething.paypal.com, it's very likely the same tool, meaning he could get access to the same information if he kept going with it. Right? So to avoid going against the policy of the PayPal bug bounty program and possibly accidentally accessing information belonging to real users, he stopped there and wrote up his report to PayPal to file it under the bug bounty program. And this is where he encountered the very first problem with the PayPal bug bounty program.
Okay.
So in their instructions, they asked that all submissions you send to them are encrypted with PGP so that someone can't read them. So only, you know, the PayPal security officer
right
can read the emails.
So it's even for security in their own network.
Yeah, but also as it gets to them, and just so that, you know, especially when some of these could be critical flaws, they just want to make sure everything's PGP encrypted in, until it's actually accessed by someone who has the right keys. The problem was the link on their bug bounty website pointed to a PGP key that was expired. So you couldn't encrypt anything with it.
Nice.
So that was on, I think, the 29th or something. On July 5th, he finally got a reply from PayPal with a real PGP key so he could send his report. So then he sent in his report on July 5th.
Mm.
On July 19th, he finally got an automated response saying that his submission had been received. So that's an awfully long lag for an automated response.
Yeah.
And then he gets an email on August 7th saying that his submission was closed as being invalid.
Oh, nice.
Because whoever was assigned to look at it couldn't reproduce the same problem.
And there's nothing more frustrating when you have a valid bug and you submit it, yeah. and then the maintainer, whoever, says, not closed, not yeah. legit.
So then he emailed back and basically managed to get it recategorized and reopened so that someone else would look at it.
Mm.
In the meantime, he's submitting a number of other bug reports from different flaws he had found. August 21st, he gets a handwritten reply in response to a different bug report, and it includes a status update saying that his original one is still open, and as soon as they fix the problem, they'll send the payment for his first case.
Well, that's a turnaround. That's good.
Yeah. And then finally, on August 29th, he received payment, except for the payment said it was for a cross-site scripting vulnerability, which isn't what he had submitted. So he emailed back and asked if it was just a mistake or what, and he never got a reply. But anyway,
I love this. I love it.
Between the time he tried to submit the bug and the time they finally responded and paid was more than 2 months, or exactly 2 months.
Huh.
And, you know, he had to jump through a bunch of hoops and, you know, he was being cooperative, but, mm-hmm. you know, it seemed like they weren't trying to make it particularly easy.
Right. So if you're on the fence about, boy, I could sell this on the black market, or I could just get a lot of cred online, or I could just, you know, get a lot of followers, versus working quietly with this company and quietly telling them about it, and they're sitting there being frustrated while you're trying to do it, you got to sit there. He's continually recalculating the value in his head as he goes. At least I would.
Exactly. And so I have a link here to his write-up, which includes a bunch of screenshots of the things he found.
Oh.
On top of, I have a link to the PDF files and so on. And then basically we get to the second part of the story. I, too, was aware of the PayPal bug bounty program. And so during my various adventures, I came across a cache of stolen PayPal accounts.
Oh, really?
Basically a database file that included the username, which is an email address, and password, and type, so business or personal, country, and dollar value in each of the PayPal accounts.
Wow.
So this huge list, it was about 7,600 PayPal accounts.
You just came across this?
Well, there's a whole story that goes behind it, but I'll have to tell that some other time when I have more time.
Okay.
But yes, I come across this file, or I come into possession of this file with 7,600 usernames and passwords and account balances in it.
Wow.
The list only contains accounts with an account balance over $100.
Okay.
So if there were people with less than that in their PayPal account, they were excluded from this list that I got.
Okay.
You add it up and there was millions of dollars in these accounts if you put it all together. So, you know, obviously the first thing you're tempted to do is try to steal some people's money.
Yeah, right?
But, you know,
were you tempted?
Security researcher, and I didn't do that. Well, it's very hard to get away with, so it wasn't that tempting.
Yeah, okay. All right.
So anyway, after going through it for a couple of days and dealing with it and so on, I submitted it to the PayPal bug bounty program on September 15th. And this whole process didn't wrap up until November 21st, which is today.
So, say again, when did you first tell them about this?
I first emailed PayPal with the encrypted email on September 15th.
And they just
So it took
today?
More than 2 months.
Today gave you the okay?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, well, I have the whole timeline here. So
yeah, okay.
I sent it on the 15th. On the 17th, I got an automated reply saying they had received my thing and properly decrypted it. Because, you know, there's always a risk that if I screwed up the PGP or something, they wouldn't have been able to read it. Anyway, on September 20th, I got a reply from a real person. So this is 5 days. It's a reasonable amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
From asking for more information. And because in the initial report, I didn't give them the entire list of accounts. I just gave them like five to prove that it was there. And because I didn't want to expose everything right away. And I wanted to see, you know, if they were even interested in taking this and so on. Anyway, so on the 20th, they asked for more information. I give them the more information, the information about where I got this information so that they could have the server seized in case they could do some more forensics on it and so on than I could do remotely, and the full database of accounts. And then it went quiet. So once you send them the initial email with PGP, after that they send you stuff to log into like this PGP webmail thing. It's some solution from the commercial PGP company.
Okay.
So it's basically a webmail hosted on their end that allows them to you and them to send encrypted emails back and forth.
Right, right.
Without you like having to have your own encryption keys and stuff in case you don't or whatever. And they just like it that way, I guess. Anyway, so I keep checking, but I never get any replies. And then finally, on October 26th, so more than a month, closer to like 6 weeks later, after they had, you know, I'd given them the extra information they asked for, they apologized for the very long delay and notified me that while my submission didn't qualify under the bug bounty program, because I didn't actually find a bug in PayPal, due to the nature of the information that I was giving them, which is a giant list of accounts which are obviously compromised, and the money in them could have been already being like basically somebody was using stolen money to fund these accounts and, you know, try to run it through enough hops that it wouldn't get traced back to them kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or it was real accounts and there was real people's money at risk.
Yeah.
Either way, PayPal has an interest in freezing those accounts, forcing password resets, and tracking where all the money came from and so on.
I would hope so.
Right. So even though it wasn't a valid bug under their bug bounty program, because it was something they wanted, they were going to pay me anyway. And that I should expect payment in about 3 weeks. And until then, and basically from the initial submission on, you're not supposed to talk about what you found until they've had a chance. Normally, it's until they've had a chance to fix the problem and pay you.
Right.
Basically, they don't pay you until they fix the problem. So, basically, that's usually when you're clear to talk about it. And so
first rule of bug bounty is don't talk about the bug.
Yes, until they pay you, and then you're free to publish.
Right.
So they finally paid me today.
Oh, so congrats. You actually got it, huh?
Yes.
Well, the timing's good on that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I was in the middle of writing the show, and I get an email, and it's like, PayPal has just sent you $1,000. I'm like, yay.
Boy, that's an email you'd like to get.
Yes. Well, if...
they PayPal to you, like, don't they?
Yes. You have to have a verified PayPal account. But the researcher that found this other bug, and multiple ones, some of the like real bugs where people's information could have been disclosed are worth much larger sums of money. Like,
did you get any idea?
At least $10,000.
Ah,
and more like $20,000 and so on.
So actually worth somebody's time.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Well, basically enough money that it's more worth your time to tell them about it than to try to get away with stealing money.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like, obviously, I had the option to try to, like, drain a couple million dollars out of these PayPal accounts.
Yeah.
But then it's like, how do I get the cash in my hands without getting caught?
Yeah. It probably, and if you could somehow put it into
an
Bitcoins.
Interesting thought experiment for a little while. But, well, because PayPal is reversible, nobody wants to sell you Bitcoins for PayPal.
Yeah.
Because
there is a way to
very
do
likely,
it,
if I was stealing this money from people's PayPal accounts, one of the people would notice.
Yeah,
and they would complain, and the money would get clawed back from the guy who gave me the Bitcoins.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he gets screwed.
Right. And that's why nobody wants to sell you Bitcoins for PayPal.
Mm-hmm. Because they'll do it. There's a special IRC channel on Freenode where that's just what they do is they trade. But you got to, you got to go. It's shady. It's like going into, it's like a back alley of the internet, right? And you go up to some guy and hope he doesn't mug you.
Right. Well, usually in this case, it's them hoping you don't mug them.
Yeah, yeah. So what was your thought experiment? What would be the way?
Well, I couldn't figure one out, but I thought about it for a couple of days just because it was an interesting thing to think about.
You know, the other way you can do it, and this is crazy, you can go from PayPal to Linden dollars for, you know, Second Life?
Yep.
And then from you can buy with Linden dollars, you can buy Bitcoins.
Right, but even then, I guess the Bitcoin.
There's still kind of a trail of accounts, so you'd have to have
and eventually, you know, Bitcoins can still be tracked.
Yeah.
Just not...
Yeah, you'd have to put them through a Tumblr, and even then, that's not 100%.
And then, basically, in the end, I have to withdraw them somehow. And, using something like the Canadian Virtual Exchange, which is a Bitcoin exchange, a reputable one, you know, if you want to withdraw more than so much money, they want photo ID and stuff.
I wonder, though...
Because their setup is actually following, like, Canadian banking laws.
I wonder if this is a way how some people invest in Bitcoins, is they compromise PayPal accounts, they somehow buy Bitcoins with that, and then they invest because they don't need to take them out. They can keep them in there and just let it, because, it's no capital out of pocket.
And, spend lots of time moving them back and forth and stuff until it's all... Because you don't move Bitcoins around as whole Bitcoins, right? It's all just a mass of hashes and so on.
Yeah.
So, you can't follow one specific Bitcoin. You're following just the value. Anyway, so I'll talk more about the story of how I got the list of accounts and stuff some other time.
Okay.
But basically, from what I gathered, it looked like they took a bunch of different password compromises, like the LinkedIn one and a bunch of other ones, and they cracked the passwords from the hashes, like the MD5s and so on, and they tried all of those against PayPal.
Mm.
So if your PayPal account uses your main email address and uses the same password you use anywhere else on the internet, then they could compromise your PayPal account the same way. We talked about the obvious worst case is people who sign up, have a Gmail account or whatever, sign up for some random web forum or something, use the same use the email address, and then use the same password as they do for their email.
Yeah,
the person can then hack their email and through that, reset a PayPal password or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But if you use the same email and password at PayPal, then you just go directly into your PayPal account.
I know I have family members that do that.
Yeah, and so I don't do that. Plus, no. I also have dedicated email addresses for all my PayPal accounts.
Yes.
And so on. But...
Yes.
Yeah.
Were you collecting your thoughts?
No, I was trying to read the chat room and
They're going on about their
all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But don't target my PayPal account. It's empty already.
I know. Be nice to us, please.
I withdrew the money because I'm putting a down payment on a house.
Yeah, that's awesome.
The money coming in today was extremely helpful.
Yeah, that is really great timing. That's awesome.
Too bad it hadn't been $20,000, but what are you gonna do?
Well, yeah,
Come on, PayPal, there was a couple of $1 million worth of funds I stopped from being fraud here.
Yeah, could you just give me a few percentages off that? Come on. All right, well, should we shift gears? You ready?
Yep.
All right, before we do that, because we have a story that, according to some of the tech press, we all need to panic about. But before we get to that, I just want to remind folks that you can support Jupiter Broadcasting when you're doing your holiday shopping this season by using our affiliate links, or maybe if you're buying supplies or something for around the house, and you buy from Amazon, or if you get some gear from Newegg or ThinkGeek. ThinkGeek's great.
Or Monoprice.
Or Monoprice, yes, which that's only an extension right now. We don't have a link down there. I should add that.
I don't even think it's an extension yet, actually.
Oh, jeez. I'm a bad person. But look, those affiliates are a way you can support
the network. Rikai is a bad person. Otherwise, it'd be in the extension already.
Oh, I can't say that, though, because he made the extension for us.
I'm teasing it,
though. And it is, by the way, our extensions are up on GitHub. How cool is that?
So if you want to, for example, fix that because Rikai is too busy, you just GitHub. Go do a pull request.
Think about it. So we have a network that is being sort of elevated by our audience because they use that system, keeps us going, and then we're putting that code out there in the public, open source, that anybody can grab and anybody can
work with.
I do
notice that a couple of people have forked it and switched it to their own affiliate codes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would figure that would happen, right? But as long as our audience continues to support us, that's all we care about. Yep. So if you'd use those links before you shop or grab these browser extensions, they not only tag those places, but we're updating to add new affiliates as they come on board. And as feature requests come in and we think about them and we work on them, we'll introduce those to the extension.
But yeah. I make extensive use of it. I did my Christmas shopping. That box there is full of ThinkGeek stuff for my family. That was, affiliated. I bought a giant box of Ethernet cables in different colors to organize our rack. Right.
iSCSI connections are one color and...
Basically, I have LAN connections are yellow, internet connections are orange.
What about like
IPMI connections are black?
DMZ for me is always black. DMZ connections are always black. Yeah.
I also bought the Velcro ties for the cables.
Yes.
So that because basically my old strategy was I had the regular zip ties,
mm-hmm.
and so I put them on very loose so it was possible to run cables.
Yeah.
To add move cables.
Yeah.
But it's still a giant pain in the ass.
Yes.
So these Velcro ones are very nice.
Yes.
And
yes.
Like I mentioned before, at Monoprice, a pack of 60 of them was the same price as a pack of 6 at my local hardware store.
Yeah, there's something tricky about the way the monoprice affiliate thing works. I can't remember what it is. I think that's why there's not a link. But I'll look into it and see if I can add it, because monoprice is so awesome.
There's a link that's easy. It's just it was harder to do in the extension because...
Because you have to
do the link URL change. is a commission junction thing, it's not just a URL tag.
Right. Yeah, like some affiliates have better support for it than others.
Yes.
I just got like a 16-foot HDMI cable for like $7 for monoprice.
Yes, and here, you know, if you go to your local Best Buy or whatever, they'll try to charge you $50 for a 6-foot HDMI cable.
Yeah.
Like, and then there's the gold-plated one for like $100.
Also, I just want to give a mention to our donate page, because some folks drop off during the holiday season because the money gets tight. So if you have $7 or $10 a month to spare, and you think that TechSnap and the other shows on Jupiter Broadcasting are worth that in value to you, maybe if you don't watch TV as much or you've canceled some other service and you want to supplement that, we really do appreciate that. And we have PayPal and Amazon Payments on there because, just like our last story, not everybody loves PayPal. Now, the crazy thing about PayPal is, despite all of its flaws, it's still like one of the best ways to move small dollar amounts around online. But we have added Amazon Payments.
Large ones, honestly.
What's that?
Even largish ones a lot of times.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the way it is.
It's like Scale Engine runs a large amount of its business through PayPal. Because
bulk of Jupiter Broadcasting donors are through PayPal. Yeah, I mean...
But also Jupiter Broadcasting pays Scale Engine through PayPal.
Right. That's right, yeah. So there you go. And it's very convenient, especially because, you know, you're in Canada
Well, that was when I was first starting my business as a hosting provider.
Yeah.
Most of my hosting bills were in U.S. dollars.
Yeah,
and my customers paid me in U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
But I'm Canadian.
Yeah.
So if I charge the bill to my Canadian credit card, I pay an extra 2.5% currency conversion fee. So basically my server bills are 2.5% more.
More, yeah.
And when I convert the U.S. dollars to Canadian dollars, PayPal or my bank charges a fee. So I end up with this like 5% spread that's getting eaten on top of the PayPal fees. And so basically it ends up like a 10% difference. Whereas if I take the money in U.S. dollars and pay for the server with my PayPal account, I don't lose that 10%.
Yeah, PayPal is just it's got staying power. But we introduced, I mean, specifically Amazon Payments because we had enough people saying, I don't really like that.
There are some people that don't like PayPal.
I have a love-hate.
I've been through, like, my first hosting business, because it was IRC-based, you know, I've went through a lot of, like, PayPal's fraud processes and stuff.
Yeah, I bet.
And I've had my account frozen because of a very large transaction involving fraud and so on. But, you know, you fax in the right paperwork and it's sorted out. But I have a lot of experience with PayPal and I'm generally happy with it.
Yeah.
Although in Canada, I also like, we have a system here from Interac, which is the network that runs our debit card system, where you can email money. But the way it works is you log into your bank's online banking. Whichever bank I happen to use, I log into their website, go to their online banking and say, I want to send a payment to, put in an email address, pick a secret question and a secret answer. And then I hit send. It sends that person an email.
Hmm.
That person clicks a link in that email, takes them to the Interac website. They select which bank they use and it takes them to their online banking. Log into your own bank's website with online banking, answer the secret question, select what account to deposit the funds in, instant.
And so as long as there's pretty much it, and does every other bank support that? So you can
Although because in Canada there are only 5 major banks.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
and a couple of the medium-sized banks support it as well. But basically it works for pretty much everybody because there's so few banks in Canada. There is support for credit unions. The difference is a person depositing to a credit union has to wait like 5 days for the funds to arrive. Whereas if you're with one of the 5 major banks, it clears instantly.
Yeah. Yeah, that figures.
The advantage to that over like PayPal or somebody is you're not trusting PayPal.
Yeah,
you only have to deal with your bank,
right? And you already presumably trust them. Hopefully,
yeah. Well, and most times, you know, if you're in a fight with PayPal, you don't have any leverage over PayPal.
Yeah,
right. Because even if you do a lot of business through PayPal, they're like,
they don't care.
We're not going to miss your couple $1,000s a month in business.
Yeah, they don't care. No. Yeah.
Right. Whereas your bank, you know, they're fairly interested in keeping you as a customer.
Right. All right.
And also keeping the reputation of, you know, being helpful.
Now, do I need to put my panic pants on this next story? Because I believe FreeBSD is ruined and the Linux can be now crowned champion of security. Is that correct? Am I correct in that?
Not even close.
Oh.
basically, there was a lot of FUD around this, so I wanted to straighten some of that out.
Yeah.
So, on the morning of November 17th, I woke up to an alarming email from the FreeBSD security officer announcing that they had detected intrusions into two servers operated by the FreeBSD project on November 11th.
Okay.
So the affected machines were taken offline immediately, and they started being analyzed, right? So they turn the machines off, image the hard drives, and start looking at everything. A large portion of the remaining infrastructure, like all the build servers and everything, was also taken offline as a precaution.
Just to be safe, yeah.
Just, you know, and they suspended basically everything and were like, let's make sure everything's okay before we do anything.
Yeah.
So the two machines that were compromised were part of the legacy third-party package building infrastructure. So basically, the way packages in FreeBSD work is there's a cluster of servers that literally just take the whole ports tree and compile everything in it all the time. There's one that does it for the purpose of finding bugs and finding things that won't build and alerting developers to that. But then there's another group that do it to make the binary packages that people can install. Right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So okay. Two of those servers were compromised.
Okay.
It is believed that they may have been compromised as early as the 19th of September, but they're not 100% sure. It couldn't have been any earlier than the 19th of December, or sorry, September. And, you know, they detected it on November 11th. The compromise is believed to have occurred due to the leak of an SSH key.
Hmm.
So a developer who has access to these machines, somehow someone got access to his SSH key and logged in.
Like if they got his laptop or his home directory or something like that.
Yeah, and you know, some people are not that careful with where they, how many places they keep their SSH keys and so on. And a lot of people that are doing anything with a script don't have a local password on their SSH key.
Right.
Because that defeats the whole point of having an automated SSH key. But it also means that anyone who gets access to that file, you cause problems.
Yeah.
Right. So the person got access using an SSH key with a valid login with someone that was supposed to have access to the server. It wasn't due to some vulnerability or code exploit in FreeBSD or any third-party software running on the FreeBSD servers. At no time did the attack place the core of the FreeBSD operating system, which, unlike Linux, it's unified. So that's the kernel, all the userland utilities, all the contributed apps like OpenSSH, Bind, OpenSSL, etc., at risk. And so none of the base operating system was ever at risk. It was only the third-party packages system, the port tree, and the binaries. However, the attacker had sufficient access to potentially allow them to compromise third-party packages. So either the binaries of the already built packages or the source for the ports tree that builds the packages. There is no evidence, even after in-depth analysis, that anything was ever touched or, you know, modified. However, the FreeBSD project does not take risks. And so what they did was all the packages they had pre-built for FreeBSD 9.1, which should be released soon, but kind of got delayed by this. So they had built all the packages that were going to ship on the CDs.
Yeah.
They've thrown all of those away and built fresh ones after they audited and made sure nothing had been touched.
Just to be crazy safe.
Just to make sure that the ones that come, the packages that come with on your DVD image are definitely not compromised.
That's good to know.
Yeah. So if you're running a system that has no third-party packages that have been installed or updated in the window between September 19th and November 11th, then you have no reason to worry at all.
Okay.
So unless you installed something new or updated one of your packages in that small window, then there's no chance of you being in trouble. And that window's that's the maximum size of the window. They're pretty sure it was less amount of time than that. So the source, the ports, and the documentation subversion repositories have all been audited, and they made sure that no changes were made at all that weren't authorized. So if you update from source using SVN or ports from SVN, then you're safe as well.
Hmm.
because those were always in a good state. They were never modified.
Okay.
However, the project cannot guarantee the integrity of any packages available for installation between September 19th and November 11th, or any ports that you compiled from the ports tree that you got from anywhere except for the FreeBSD SVN server.
Okay.
Although, so if you update from CVS, because everything's in SVN and they just export it to CVS for backwards compatibility, they can't be sure that those weren't modified. They don't think they were, but they can't be sure. So
no reason to believe it, but...
Yeah. So, although there is no evidence to suggest any tampering took place or that there was any interference, the FreeBSD project recommends that if you did update or build your machine between November 19th and November 11th, that you reinstall those machines.
Okay.
Since in that case, they're probably new anyway, so probably not that big of an impact. But basically, if you're interested in being sure, just because the FreeBSD project is interested in being absolutely sure that it's secure, if you are, then you should reinstall the machine from scratch from trusted sources, meaning getting a fresh source. So I have a link to the post they did up because instead of just having the mailing list, they actually put up a website about it where they updated over time because when this first started, they also froze PortSnap, which is the binary way to update your ports tree.
Mm-hmm.
They froze it at a known good snapshot.
Aha, that's a good idea.
That basically, they verified that was good against the SVN repository. And then they stopped building new ones until they had validated everything, that any new one would be built properly and safely.
That's good.
I think after like a day or two, they had that resumed. So PortSnap is back to providing daily updates.
Very nice. So not that big of a deal. And actually, almost more of a good exercise in a sense because...
Yes, it's like a case study in how to properly handle these type of attacks.
Right.
You find one of your servers is compromised, shut everything down, and start looking at everything. And, you know, to validate some of the packages they had built, like the ones that were sitting on the FTP servers, they compared those to offsite backups from before this window.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, SHA-256 sum says the file's the same, then they know that file hasn't been tampered with.
Right.
But for the 9.1 packages, because they weren't published yet, because 9.1 isn't out yet, they didn't have anything to compare those against. So they threw them away and made fresh ones.
That's why, okay.
Right? Because they couldn't verify 100% for sure that those files hadn't been tampered with.
You know, as somebody who, you know, would deploy this type of code in my infrastructure, I appreciate that. You know, I appreciate that level of trust that I can still put in the security of it. So that's some people might think that's going overboard, but...
Right, but I think the biggest difference is compared to what we've talked about with other compromises and companies when they disclose it, is they assumed everything was compromised until they could, each thing they could prove wasn't compromised.
Right, we hear some companies
we have no reason to believe that this was compromised. Yeah. Whereas FreeBSD is like, we assume everything is compromised, we individually verified, all right, this definitely wasn't compromised, the source tree wasn't, the SVN is good, and these files, we checked against the backups, they're not modified, they're good.
Right.
Ports tree during this time, we can't actually prove that they're good, so we assume they're bad. If you used it, reroll your machine. It's obviously excessive, and there's very likely no reason to bother.
Yeah.
But they don't assume that.
Gotta play it safe.
Yeah, exactly. They're very conservative about that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some of this FreeBSD stuff does run. You know,
it did get some good play, though. I was smirking at the amount of play that the story got. I thought, I bet Alan's seeing the story go around right now, and he's just rolling his eyes. He's just rolling his eyes right now.
Well, the first thing I did is read every scrap of information.
Right, of course, of course.
There.
Yeah.
I need to know, is there something I need to do?
You're right. Do I have a problem?
You know, we have no servers that were affected by that.
Right.
So we're okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, can we take a quick break right here?
Yes.
And thank our sponsor this week. They got such a great deal for us, Alan. It's such a good deal. I printed it out. I printed it out just so that way I could, like, it didn't seem real to me until I physically held it in my hand. So check this out. We've been telling you about great deals. This is the deal of all deals, especially for those of us who are security conscious. So thank you to GoDaddy.com for sponsoring this week's episode of TechSnap. Check this out. They have an offer, and it is for a limited time only. It expires at the end of December. For $4.99, you can buy yourself an SSL cert. Now, that's a great price because usually they're about, I don't know, $13 from GoDaddy. But here's the real savings, and this applies for multiple years. Yes. You can get the renewal price at $12.99. That's usually $70. So that is a crazy great deal. Just use our code 499SSL2. 499SSL2. When you check out at GoDaddy.com, boom! You're supporting the TechSnap program.
You can buy an SSL certificate for multiple years for $4.99 a year.
And GoDaddy is a fantastic place to get an SSL cert from. That's where I've gotten all of my SSL certs from for all of my clients and for myself. And
a lot of mine are from there, too.
I can completely recommend them for this service. And at that price, $4.99 for an SSL cert. Just use the code 499SSL2. We have a link in the show notes. And look, even if you don't think you're going to take advantage of this, if you want to support the TechSnap program, just click the link on our show notes and take a look at what they're offering. Just going and visiting that page supports this show. And you might know. You might find something you want to get while you're there. So
somebody asked how long it lasts. You said the end of December?
The code is good till the end of December. You can also lock in the $12.99 renewal price for multiple years, which is the long term savings, because usually that's $70. So that's crazy, Alan. That's crazy. I mean,
butt ton of money there.
Yeah. Thank you to GoDaddy for doing that. Now look, we also have a couple other codes.
$4.99. I think I can think of a couple SSL certificates I could use.
I know. It's crazy. I think I'm going to get SSL certificates to everybody in my family for Christmas. Here you go, Mom. Here you go, Dad. Here's an SSL certificate. And they'll think, man, he must have spent a lot of money. You can also get a .com for $5.99 if you use the code 599TECH. Or if you're just buying something special or you're doing some renewals and you want to take 20% off, you want to take 20% off the whole order, just use our code GO20OFF5. We have those listed out in the show notes if you forget. And thank you to everybody who supports our sponsor. And a big thank you to GoDaddy for supporting the TechSnap program for a long time now. And happy Thanksgiving to the folks at GoDaddy. Man, $4.99 SSL2 to get that SSL cert for $4.99. That's awesome.
An insanely low price.
Thank you, GoDaddy. All right, Alan, why don't we move on to our next story? It's going to be a big one. PHP 5.5 is introducing some new password features, isn't it?
Yes. So basically, PHP 5.5 is introducing a new API for doing password hashing. Basically, before this, there was a command in PHP a function called crypt, which is basically based on the one provided that's part of the C API that's actually provided by the operating system.
Okay.
Right? So it's you know, it kind of assumes you understand completely how password hashing works.
Probably a bad assumption to make.
Yeah. And basically, also it means that there's a lot of plumbing you have to do every time you want to use password hashes.
Code.
Well, not quite, yeah, a bunch of
a lot
code.
Of code, though.
Yeah.
And that code could get screwed up, or that code is just a pain in the ass.
Yeah, if you make a small mistake in there. And also, the way it reports errors can be weird sometimes. They have an RFC here about, you know, because 5.5 is not quite finalized yet, they want to hear anything you want to suggest that might change about this before it becomes the, you know...
law of the land?
Yeah, before
standard,
it becomes the API that's...
The method that's done? Yeah.
Because part of this is about it's also providing a lot more future-proofing than the current API does.
They're probably, you know, hoping some security heads get their eyes on this and look at it and validate.
Well, yes. Basically, they're hoping to see that apps and forums that are based in PHP, and basically everybody that writes anything in PHP will not be one of the people that ends up with one of these silly password compromises because they used just a plain MD5 hash in their database or just a plain SHA-256 like LinkedIn. And so on. So the first question is, why do we need password hashing? Right? It's the point of password hashing is to store passwords in such a way that we can still verify that the user is entering the correct password, but if someone has access to our database, they can't easily determine what the user's password is.
Right, because if it's encrypted, it can be decrypted.
Right, so you know your options are plain text, which means anybody that can look at your database can see the passwords. A lot of apps still do this, and it's very, very bad practice. Some of them, you know, you see people that don't know any better that would encrypt the passwords. That means that there's some password you use to encrypt everybody's password. That also means that password will decrypt all those passwords. So it means if someone can get if someone's accessing your database, they probably also have access to the source code for your website, and they'll be able to figure out what that password is and decrypt all the passwords, and then they have them in plain text.
Yeah.
Not very useful. And then, yeah. So then the next question is, why do we need strong cryptographic password hashing? Because when we use regular hashing functions like MD5 or SHA-256 or 512, it's not good enough. Regular hashing algorithms are designed to be fast, because that's what you normally want from a hashing algorithm, right? If you're the FreeBSD project and you need to find the SHA-256 sum of 23,000 package files, you want it to be fast.
Yeah.
That's what SHA and MD5 are designed for. But that's actually undesirable when you're doing passwords, because it means someone can try a lot of attempts against the hash to find the one that is the same.
Uh-huh.
Right? So they basically, a hash is a one-way function. You can take something and hash it, but you can't go from the hash back to the password. Right? Because the password could be any length and the hash is always the same length. Right? So there's many hashes. Sorry, there's many inputs that result in the same hash, so you could never be sure which one of them it was even.
Hmm.
Even if you could reverse it. But you can't, because there's so many possible results. Anyway, the reason you don't want to use those is because somebody can run a brute force attack. Just try every password and hash it really quickly. You know, especially we've seen with Bitcoin and so on, SHA-256 hashes are, you can calculate them pretty quick on video cards.
Yeah.
Like in the rates of...
gigaflops.
Yeah. It's like... it's like one video card is like 700 or 800 mega hashes sometimes.
Yeah, that's right. That's yeah, giga hash and mega hash. 800
million attempts at a password per second.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't take very long to run through a large, like all the 8-letter passwords.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so the regular hashing algorithms are fast, and we don't like that. Additionally, if you use just a hash, it's also subject to rainbow tables, which is basically where you pre-calculate what the hashes would be. You know, if you've hashed the password, you know, 123456 one time, then you already know what it is next time. So a rainbow table is basically a giant database file where you write down every password and what its hash is. So that when you break a database like LinkedIn, you can just look up those hashes in your rainbow table, and it tells you what the passwords are in a couple of seconds.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that takes a lot of storage, right? You need terabytes and terabytes of storage to hold these rainbow tables.
Or use one of the online ones.
Yes. But, you know, somebody needs... it's called the time-memory trade-off. You're saving a lot of time, but it takes a huge amount of storage.
Mm-hmm.
What cryptographic hashes do is add a salt value. So depending on the algorithm, it's a different size, but like for MD5... cryptographic hashes is 8 characters. For bcrypt, it's 22 characters. So you're adding basically 22 letters onto the password to make the password stronger. So if you have an 8-letter password and you're adding 22 characters of salt, that's now a 30-character password. Although the salt is given away as part of the hash, so someone cracking it only has to crack the 8-letter part, so it doesn't help that much. But the main thing it does is it ensures that passwords are unique. So if you and I both have the same password,
mm-hmm.
we're going to have different random salts, so our hashes are going to come out different.
Oh, that's so huge. That means,
well, the biggest thing it does is means there's no economy for the attacker.
Right.
If I'm brute forcing, I have to brute force every possible password against every possible user.
Right, right.
Whereas, for example, with Windows' old LM hash, which was based on MD4, there was no salt, so you just tried every possible password, and... you could, each attempt would allow you to check against every user. So you'd only have to do the math once to crack 100 accounts.
Right, exactly.
So if you go through the entire password space once, you would get every account. With a salt, you have to go through the entire password space for each separate salt. And so you basically eliminate any economy by making the user, the attacker, have to try every password against every account.
Mm-hmm.
And then The other thing cryptographic hashes usually have is what's called a stretching or slowing algorithm. And what that does is make the hash slower or take longer. So like SHA-512 crypt, right? So instead, you know, SHA-512 is a hash that runs once and is very fast. And SHA-512 crypt has a salt and runs by default 10,000 times. So you're taking like the hash of the hash of the hash times 10,000, mm-hmm. with a salt in there as well. So that means that each attempt takes 10,000 times longer to try, right? So each password I'm going to guess takes 10,000 times longer. You know, if that's, you know, 10 milliseconds for one attempt, that's great on the defensive side, right? On my server where you're logging in against legitimately, it takes 10 milliseconds, whatever. But on the attacker who's trying billions of passwords, that fact that it takes 10 milliseconds instead of 0.001 milliseconds means that it takes him 10,000 times longer to try to hack each password. And then some algorithms like Bcrypt, which is the one based on Blowfish,
yeah.
and the one that we recommend, and it's also the default one in this new PHP API, is also resistant to acceleration by GPUs so far.
Right.
So far, they've never been able to make Bcrypt faster on a GPU than it is on a CPU.
That's a good thing.
Whereas all the other algorithms so far, GPU is faster. And then there's other algorithms. There's a new one called Scrypt, which is designed to be memory intensive instead. So it has a time memory trade-off in that if you give it more memory, it doesn't take as long to calculate. And that's specifically designed to make it resistant to attacks by ASICs and FPGAs, which are basically dedicated processors that would be designed to crunch it really quickly. It's actually, remember we talked about that online, that cloud crack or whatever,
mm-hmm.
where you could give it some capture from like a WPA2 and it would crack it?
Yeah.
Well, that's what they're using. One of these, they're basically using hardware that's hard-coded just to crack this as fast as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Scrypt is designed to protect against those type of attacks.
Okay.
Attacks by dedicated hardware. By basically requiring that dedicated hardware to have huge amounts of memory to try to do a lot of these calculations at once. And that makes that hardware expensive.
Mm-hmm.
We consider RAM pretty cheap, but if you're trying to crack huge amounts of passwords, you're going to need huge amounts of memory. So, the new PHP password hashing API makes the process of generating and validating hashes much easier. You don't. It basically eliminates most of the steps. You don't have to try to come up with the salt yourself. It'll do it automatically unless you specify one. Because basically by default in PHP, if you didn't provide a hash, it would generate one randomly, but it would use the algorithm DES. So your salt would be two characters. And basically DES is like a joke. It's literally from the early 90s. It's not very useful. So basically with Crypt, unless you specified otherwise, it would use a really bad algorithm and so on. So to tell it to do MD5 or Blowfish or Bcrypt, you had to give it a salt with the identifiers on the front, right? Like $1 is, MD5 and $2A is Blowfish. And I think it was $5 is SHA. So you had to come up with the hash or the salt yourself. And basically, there's all these steps you had to do to make it work. Now, there's just three methods you use, and they kind of return true or false, and it all works the way you want. The new API also allows you to optionally specify what hash to use, but if you don't specify, it uses Bcrypt, which is the strongest one, rather than DES, which is the weakest one. Right? The old Crypt thing, the idea was backwards compatibility. The new PHP one, the idea is security. Right. Also, in the future, PHP may change the default password hash to a newer algorithm. So instead of using Blowfish, in the future they may switch to say Scrypt.
So as long as you're writing to this new API or whatever.
Yes, if you write to the new API and don't override the default hash, you'll automatically upgrade to the newer hash when the newer version of PHP pushes that.
That's a nice advantage.
Yes. The reason it can do that is because hashes now have $number $ in front of them that identifies what algorithm
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
And so if you're running, a forum, like the Jupyter Colony forum, and everybody signs up, and they all have Blowfish hashes, Bcrypt, and then the new version happens, and it's switched to Scrypt. Anyone that signs up new will have a password hashed with Scrypt instead of Bcrypt. But that doesn't help the people that are still using Blowfish, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a second method in this that checks if a password needs to be upgraded. So basically, it checks what algorithm a hash is and against what it should be.
Like when they log in or something?
Yeah, so exactly. So when the user logs in, you have access to their plain text password, right? Because you need that to calculate the hash to compare it to the hash in the database. The main thing is you don't keep the plain text password. You throw it away when you're done.
Mm-hmm.
So when the user attempts to log in, you check that the password they entered is correct by hashing it and comparing it to the hash that's in the database. Now, in the old way, you would have had to read the thing from the database, parse it out, and figure out which algorithm it was and write your stuff that way. Basically, you'd have to manually hash the password they entered using the algorithm that was for the one in the database. You have to figure it out first. So you'd have to figure out what algorithm the database used and then hash their attempt with that and then compare the two. The new API does all that work for you. But anyway, there's a new method that compares the hash in the database to the currently selected algorithm and tells you whether you need to upgrade that hash or not.
Huh.
If you do, so basically you check and make sure you do the regular check that they entered the right password. If they did and they do need to upgrade, right, it's Bcrypt and you've switched to Scrypt, then it will take the plain text password, hash it using the new algorithm, and overwrite what's in the database with the new algorithm, and then continue. So that way, the first time each user logs in after the algorithm change, their hash gets upgraded to the new algorithm.
I like that.
The user never has to like reset their password. Just the next time they log in, they get upgraded.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, you could force a reset on anybody who hasn't logged in 6 months or something.
Yeah, that would be the only thing you'd have to keep is people who didn't log in, you'd have to still trim those up.
Yeah. We actually went through the same system with the services database on Geekshed, although it was years and years ago.
The IRC platform.
It was MD5 hash, and it switched to SHA with assault. And, you know, we didn't want to go through the pain of making everybody reset their password or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so just as people identified, normally we would upgrade their password in the database.
Right.
And then after, also on IRC, we have the system where if you don't use your name for like 30 days, it expires.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So anybody who wasn't logging in was getting deleted anyway. And then there was a couple of people we had to manually reset their password for them because a few people who have the no expire flag. And so they hadn't logged in, so we just reset their password for them. And we're like, well, we'll deal with them when they show up.
Right.
And so on. So anyway, that means that it also takes care of the upgrading process for you automatically. So you can write to this one API and you'll never have to change it and your passwords will keep getting upgraded over time.
I like this. This is something they needed a while ago.
And it has the flexibility to also pass extra information to the hashing algorithms.
Oh.
Like for Blowfish, you have the number of rounds, which is that logarithmic value that specifies how much time it spends on each password.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll be able to dial that up over time as well. Huh. And basically it's set up in such a way that some new algorithm that hasn't been invented yet that's going to have some weird parameter is still going to work with this API. And that's kind of what we're looking for.
Yeah.
So this will make it easier for everybody to do it, remove the possibility of most common mistakes, and make it future-proof.
Boy, I like that. So that's going to be in 5.5?
Yes, which is supposed to come out in beta soon. But you don't have to wait.
Oh.
Because 5.5 probably isn't going to be in production for a while. Like 5.4 has come out, but there was some, like, as far as I know, WordPress doesn't work properly in 5.4 yet. Mm. And so most people are still running 5.3. And some, so on GitHub, there's a pure PHP implementation of the API. So you can start using it today.
That's great.
And the library is set up in such a way that as soon as your PHP is upgraded to 5.5 and it has the new API, the library will just not load it its bit, and that way you'll be able, it'll like seamlessly switch over to using the native one as soon as that becomes available.
Very nice.
And which also might be helpful is it means you can write the app with the library and then deploy it on some machines that have 5.5 and some machines that are still 5.3 or whatever, mm-hmm. and it'll work on both. So yes, you don't even need to have the 5.5.
You can use it in 5.5. That.
Yes.
You got to appreciate that. Well, all right. So
if you develop anything that uses passwords, you should get that library and start using it today.
Yeah. I've actually been hearing a lot of more dogging on PHP than there used to be in the past, but every now and then they're rolling out of new features we're talking about.
Most of the problems are not so much with PHP, but just the way people use it. And
yes.
Making changes like this to remove that ambiguity and make it easy for people to use is a good thing.
Yeah. All right.
You know, I keep explaining that people should do their password hashing in this way, but we've seen even big places like LinkedIn weren't doing it this way.
Yeah.
Now they have no excuse.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Seriously. That's
it's like, well, we've been harping on this issue for a while, but now PHP has done the step they needed to make it even easier. So
now
that,
they get it for free, so they better use it.
Exactly.
Yeah. And hopefully that's how they look at it. Hopefully they look at it, well, it's free in terms of development cost now, so we're just going to... And with CPU power as raw as it is, there's just no reason not to. All right. Well, our next story is sort of one of those ones that I'd heard rumors circulating about just through back channels. People were speculating that maybe there was some sort of bug in iOS that was causing podcast clients to turn into little mini portable denial of service machines in your pocket, as it were.
Yes.
This next story actually hasn't even been officially acknowledged by Apple yet, but it's been uncovered by the guys over at PRX.org. They have a blog post up. And I had heard a couple of podcasters. I have a buddy, Chase, who joins me on Unfilter, and he had kind of asked me about it. And I'd heard Adam Curry over at the No Agenda show was having problems with this, but it actually got brought to life because This American Life approached the PRX.org guys and said, hey, could you look into this? We're getting extremely high bills from our CDN. And
Because, you know, a lot of CDNs aren't as inexpensive as scale engine.
That's true. That's true. This actually really had no material financial impact on us at all, thankfully, thanks to that. But some people really got screwed. People that were on like Akamai or Rackspace or Amazon.
Amazon, if you're using CloudFront on top of S3, that's like 24 cents a gigabyte, or 25 cents, I think.
Yeah.
Whereas the list price at Scale Engine is 8 cents.
So,
if you get 50% more usage, there's a big difference there.
Yeah. And so people really started noticing when iOS 6 came out and Apple introduced this new podcasting app. There's a bug in iOS 6 that appears to still be there that only applies to HTTP downloads, right, Alan?
Right.
And it's like the multi-part resume capability in the HTTP download where it'll request a chunk and then...
Yeah, the way the iPhone does it is it does what's called a range request saying, hey, web server, please send me bytes X through Y for this file. And it'll basically keep doing that in little chunks. Apparently, though, it was asking for overlapping chunks, so downloading the same chunk of the file a bunch of times.
Yeah, they have a video here where this guy was downloading This Week in Tech. And even once the iPhone would finish downloading the file, it would actually then immediately begin downloading it all over again. And this was combined with a bug that shipped in iOS 6.0 that made the system think you were on Wi-Fi when you were connected to your 4G. So it would iOS automatically does certain things that it normally would not do on 3G or 4G. It waits till
right.
Wi-Fi. And right. So it kicked
like,
all those things off.
I'm not going to, like, on an Android, it won't update your apps unless you're on Wi-Fi to not, you know, you don't want it running up your bandwidth bill when you're on 3G or whatever. And, yeah, so the iOS here was doing stuff that normally only do on Wi-Fi.
Like, well, specifically, the podcast apps on iOS 6 generally don't automatically update and refresh and download if you're not on Wi-Fi. And iOS itself won't do its Delta-based image backup. You know, it's a small image, but it's actually mm-hmm. doing image backups to iCloud every single night, but only when you're on Wi-Fi. So that combined with this multi-range request issue sort of really put things over the top. Now, 6.0.1 fixes the Wi-Fi problem, and that's been out for weeks now. But it looks like this particular problem is still an issue. And so some
The range request thing is possibly still an issue.
And so some podcasters are getting like a denial of service effect after a couple of hours of release of their episode because one person's maybe making 30, 40 requests for the same file.
Yeah.
And if you stream it, if you just sit there and stream it and listen to it, it just keeps doing it over and over and over again the entire
time. Yeah, and you get with a lot of people doing that, and it can be an issue. Especially if you're serving with something like Apache that where each worker's a much bigger load than something like Nginx.
Yeah.
And also, most CDNs, including like Amazon and Scale Engine, charge a fee per request as well. Scale Engine on a CDN is 85 cents per million requests. Well, if the phone is making, you know, five times the regular number of requests, that's going to also affect your bill.
Yeah. They were not able to produce this bug on iOS 5. So it was something they introduced in iOS 6, and it appears to affect the AV Foundation framework. So any application that relies on the AV Foundation that then goes and does the sort of HTTP download is impacted by the bug. So that's like all of the podcasting apps and a lot of other apps too.
Yeah. So on top of running up CDN bills for all these podcasts, it was also eating up people's data plans with their cell phone provider.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty. So if you have an iOS 6 based device like an iPad or an iPhone, and you've noticed that, that might be what's going on. We've got links to
also,
Ars Technica.
If you had a data overage on an iPhone 6, iOS 6 device, you may be able to contest it with your phone company.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was Verizon.
Yep.
At least was talking about not charging for overages during the period because they realized it wasn't your fault.
Yep. Verizon. No word from AT&T yet on that. We have links to the Next Web and Ars Technica on this story. But it's like one of those things where I've actually heard people say, this is a conspiracy to run up bills. And I don't think that's what it is. I just think it's...
No, it's just a bug. But why couldn't that happen more to my customers? I like running up people's bills.
You never know. Maybe it did. But, you know, the podcasters who did not have their files on a CDN, like they just host it on their web server... Man, did they bite it.
Especially if they were just using Apache and couldn't handle that kind of range requests all the time. Person staying longer and more people at once and just the constant hammering.
The No Agenda show is sometimes like 120 megabytes for an MP3 file. And I think they just host it on some Apache server. And I was having an email exchange with one of their guys who does some of the stuff for them. And I was like, look, you guys got to – I don't care if it's Libsyn. Just put it on a freaking CDN. Put it somewhere. Yeah. Get it off that Apache server. And he's like, well, no, it's this iOS bug.
You did recommend Scale Engine.
Of course I did.
I am buying a house. I could use that custom.
they're convinced that, well, no, it's this iOS problem. And once it's fixed, it won't be an issue anymore. It's like, no. This is a sign that it should be on a CDN anyways. Now, if they weren't using something like Scale Engine, they would have had an enormous bill, but – their bandwidth bill
would have been cheaper than anybody else. But yes.
They had an outrageous bandwidth bill for their provider. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, should we talk a little more about password hashing at scale? Yes. I mean, everybody loves some hash talk, Alan.
Yes.
Hash night on TechSnap.
OpenWall, which is the guys that developed John the Ripper, the password cracking software.
Oh yeah.
Gave a talk at the YAC or yet another conference 2012, which was in Moscow, about password hashing at scale, meaning cracking very large numbers of passwords, like the LinkedIn list and so on. So the talk covers some of the challenges of doing online and offline attacks and so on. But it also dove... I have the link here. They have all their slides up with lots of information. But they also cover the pros and cons of things like the UBHSM, which is a little USB hardware security module that you plug into a server.
Uh-huh.
It's from the guys that make the YubiKey, and it allows you to... I think it stores some of your sensitive keys on the YubiKey and controls access to them better. And they talk about the pros and cons of that. They cover...
Here's a picture of it right here, yeah.
Yeah, and they're basically talking about over the next couple of years, how are things going to change? Including right now, bcrypt is considered the best, right? And it doesn't get accelerated by GPUs. But they talk about future vulnerabilities in PBKDF2 and bcrypt. In particular, those ones, bcrypt, you can parallelize that if you're the attacker, right? If you have 24 cores and you're an attacker, then you can sit there and try to crack 24 passwords at once to use all your cores. But if you're the defender, if you're just the person that's normally doing it, each login attempt is only using one of your cores. Right? You can't say, I'm going to dial up the number of rounds on my bcrypt so that instead of taking 100 milliseconds, it takes 3 seconds. But then if you were to be able to spread that across 24 cores, then, you know, it wouldn't take very long, right? It'd be like 125 milliseconds.
Yeah.
But if you were, say, under attack, well, someone was trying to do this a lot, it would slow down. But anyway, yeah, so bcrypt, you can parallelize it if you're the attacker, but not if you're the defender. So that's kind of a weakness. And so on. And basically, it talks about what's wrong with that. And then the proposed solution is scrypt. And they talk about the advantages and possible problems with scrypt. So scrypt was invented by Colin Percival, who was the FreeBSD security officer until spring of this year. And he built that for Tarsnap, his secure online backup product.
Oh, yeah.
But it's open source. I think it's even BSD licensed. I'm almost 100% sure it is. But specifically, scrypt is designed to be much more secure against hardware brute force attacks, like ASICs and FPGAs, because most other algorithms are not resistant to that. And it uses a time memory trade-off, and basically requiring a larger amount of RAM to reduce the amount of CPU cycles it takes. So it can take a really long time, or it can take a lot of RAM, or you can kind of move the slider back and forth.
Hmm.
But it never gets any easier. You just trade off which thing it's expensive in. When they did some tests, scrypt is roughly 4,000 times greater cost than doing a similar attack against bcrypt to find the same password. So if you have an scrypt hash and a bcrypt hash for a specific password and you're trying to brute force that, scrypt will be 4,000 times more costly to crack per password, and 20,000 times more costly than the PBKDF2. Right? So it's that much harder for the attacker that way. Then there's also an implementation of scrypt for encrypting files.
Good.
When they did a comparison on that, the cost of cracking the password to decrypt a file encrypted with scrypt is 100 billion times more costly than cracking the same file encrypted with the OpenSSL ENC command. So if you encrypt it with OpenSSL with a password and then use the same password encrypted with scrypt, cracking the scrypt version will be 100 billion times more costly, which is a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much makes it undoable.
Not necessarily.
You don't
but
think
yeah.
so?
Well, yes, the whole point
for
is...
For now, right? For now?
It's unfeasibly expensive, yes.
Yeah, I guess that's... Okay, all right. Okay, yeah. Never say never, or maybe... Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can also... scrypt is like dial a yield, basically. You set how much memory it uses when you calculate it the first time, and that... You can just keep setting that to more and more memory and more time until... And that makes it more expensive for the person who has to attack it.
Hmm. I like that.
Yep. And scrypt is now an IETF, or Internet Engineering Task Force, internet draft. So it's basically on its way to becoming a standard. And I have a link to the IETF draft as well.
Hmm. I like it, Alan. I like it. That's good stuff. I mean... It's all like both these last couple stories are like stuff that's down the road a bit, but good.
Yep.
I like that.
You know, we see that PHP is adopting bcrypt because MD5 and SSA and so on are not very good anymore for this. But
the
we also see that. Yeah, but we also see from the open wall thing that in the future it's probably going to become necessary to switch from bcrypt to scrypt. So if starting now everybody writes their. Yeah. web apps against an API like this one for PHP, even something similar in another language, like if you're writing it in Python or Ruby or whatever.
Right.
It means that in the future, we'll be able to seamlessly upgrade to scrypt.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're building an app make sure it has that bit in there about upgrading the hash. So when you change your hashing algorithm from bcrypt to scrypt or some other thing that doesn't even exist yet, you'll be able to silently upgrade all your users as the first time they log in.
I love that. All right, Alan. Well, any other thoughts on that one?
Nope. That's about it.
All right. Well, there you go, folks. Told you it was a big news docket. That was a lot of stuff we had to cover. This is a holiday week, too. I'm glad. Good thing we didn't skip a show. That would have been that would have been a train wreck. All right. Well, with all of that done, that means...
TechSnap does not skip shows.
TechSnap doesn't... The news does not rest, so therefore TechSnap does not rest. And neither do your emails. So that means it's time for the TechSnap feedback. Thanks for sending your emails to TechSnap at JupiterBroadcasting.com or hitting that contact link at the top of Jupiter Broadcasting or starting the thread in our Reddit over at links.techsnap.tv. Gonna get through some emails now. Alan, are you ready for our first email? Okay. Comes in from Carl, and he wants to take me to task. And we've actually already responded to him in private, but I thought I'd just paraphrase, and just that way we can address it on air for a few people who might have the same thought. He was concerned about some of our coverage of Debian KFreeBSD, which is a version of Debian that uses the kernel of FreeBSD in there. Yeah. So you still get like your GNU user land utilities, and then you get the FreeBSD kernel. And he kind of goes on to point out some of the great advantages of the software, but I think the core of his question is he sort of
Wasn't sure whether we knew that there was such a thing.
Right. And if we did, he wanted to kind of know why I seem so dismissive of it and not, you know, because we've had a few
people write in. And me as well, because I was very dismissive of it.
On last and on this show.
Right. Because part of it was when we were talking about PCBSD's Warden, and we talked about how the Linux you install in jail, I think, is actually Debian KFreeBSD. Because obviously, why use FreeBSD's Linux emulation when you can have a version of Linux that's specifically designed to run with a FreeBSD kernel? although the reason to use the emulation is for binaries. Like if you're using a commercial application for Linux, like Flash Media Encoder or something, or Flash Media Server, then you have to use it. But anyway,
I would propose to Carl that because you said in your email. The reason why would you run you said I think something to the effect of why would I run FreeBSD kernel with all the GNU userland stuff when I could run the FreeBSD kernels with all the FreeBSD userland stuff.
Right.
And I don't know if it's that same exact thing, but I kind of feel the same way. If I'm going to use Debian, I expect it to be Debian through and through, Debian Linux. Right. You know.
Well, you know, there are if you're used to Debian and you know you like its package manager or whatever. Although I don't think most of the packages would work with a different kernel. Maybe they have a separate repo. I don't know.
I wouldn't even be. It's not so much about that for me. It's more about so because I'm a contractor. When I build a system, I'm always thinking I have to hand this off. And so how do I transition my responsibility of this to somebody else? And it has to be something that somebody else is going to know how to work with. So there's that component. There's also like I have to recommend something that's going to be scalable and stable and also going to be compatible with
and
a lot of applications.
And also it's probably going to exist in the future.
There's that too. Right? It's more likely that FreeBSD in its entirety or Debian in its entirety will exist. There's more likely there's going to be strange technical snafus or interactions with it, although it could be absolutely fine and I've never used it, and it could be. Could be the best, you know, it could be like putting peanut butter and chocolate together, honestly. I mean, for all I know.
Specifically, like, when I first heard about Debian KFreeBSD and so on, it was basically in FreeBSD what they would consider a fourth tier architecture, meaning that if you find a bug and you don't provide the patch for it, it's very unlikely to get fixed, right? It's not something that the whole project is worried about.
Now, Barbell Wobble in the chat room is saying, I've suggested before because I wanted Linux but ZFS. Now, maybe you have a specific work condition. You know, you for like a file server and you're a Debian shop, but you want ZFS and you want true kernel ZFS.
Yes.
Maybe.
And, you know, there are some cases where maybe that makes sense. Just for me, coming from an all FreeBSD shop. But the other main thing is that it's just really not considered production ready yet. And so I probably would never use it.
Yeah, that's the thing. We're production guys.
In production. Like maybe at my house, but at my house, I tried to keep Linux out of my house.
Oh, ouch, snap. All right, well, maybe we should just move on, because now we're getting into it. Now we're getting into
it. Even my Raspberry Pi is going to run PSD.
Alan, you're hurting me here. All right. Well, the next email is just more of a PSA, but we want to put it out there, because I'm sure we have some Android ROM users out there. Came in from Vron. He says, the second most popular aftermarket Android ROM website was hacked, and the passwords were compromised and malware infested. I assume the site was. Google says this site may harm your computer if you go to it in the search engine. And using going direct, you also get site under maintenance. He said, I suspected something was wrong seeing this behavior. My suspicion was confirmed by their Google Plus page. I just want to let people know, and maybe it's worth checking out if you got ROMs from there. The site is aokp.com, I think, or .co, something like that.
Yeah.
Directly to aokp.co, yeah. There you go.
Yeah,
all right.
So if you get ROM from there, be careful. And if you had an account there, make sure you didn't use that password anywhere else. And if you did, go change it now and stop doing that.
Perfect. All right. The next one comes in. Oh, boy. I didn't pre-read this name. Jonathan. J-O-N-A-T-A-N. Jonathan. Passwords and policies on hosted panels. First of all, thank you for the awesome show. You're my number one news source of all things technical. Wow, thank you. As a donating listener, I do, however, have a topic suggestion. Soon after I started listening to pretty much the entire Jupiter Broadcasting Network, I signed up with GoDaddy's Deluxe Hosting. And it's pretty much been awesome. Except, when you create new users, deploy WordPress or whatnot, I feel a little constricted by their password policies. Should I be concerned? And is there a convenient way to create my own longer secure passwords? Once again, thanks for the awesome show. You're usually a month or so ahead of the official news channels, if they mention it at all. Well, isn't that true?
I don't know exactly what the restrictions are, as long as you're... And there may be a technical reason for them.
I can't remember. You know, I've used it before. I think I may have hit into it before. I think it's more about like how the automated deployment systems work and the different systems there. Right. Because at the end of the day, if they're hashing it, does it really matter how long the password is?
No. But, you know, if you're feeding stuff through shell scripts to set it up automatically in the background, there is, for GoDaddy security, reason them not wanting certain special shell type characters in it.
Right.
But
right, exactly. It's, stuff that would break scripts. Now, what I do
is I
just
like GoDaddy might be do a better job there, but I'm not sure exactly. Like in WordPress, yes, you can just go into WordPress and change the password after or whatever, and you don't have to use their hosted panel to set up WordPress users.
Right, that's exactly what you can do. What I have done is because I like taking advantage of all their automatic deployment stuff, is LastPass, just I have different passwords for all those different things, and you only use them when you're in logged into that environment. So it's not like somebody can remotely connect and then use those passwords, right? So you have to be logged into your GoDaddy account. And I have a crazy password on that. And then you have to be in that area of the system. And then I just have LastPass automatically fill in the different credentials for the different things. And, you know, it's not ideal, but it works. I'd love to see them, you know, make it unlimited or whatever.
Also, well, the advantage with LastPass is that you get a long password and it doesn't necessarily have to contain any characters that aren't going to be allowed.
Yep. You can even tell when it's generating it to say, avoid this type of stuff that screws it up, and it's really nice. All right.
Because I actually had a problem with the reward points site for my bank's credit card thing. I was using my points to buy my ticket to go to MeetBSD. And when I was setting up my account, it asked me for a password, and I put one in with some special characters in it. And then I couldn't log in with that password. And so I was like, I must have, you know, fat fingered it or something, reset it, same password, try again, still not.
Yeah.
Try the password without the special characters, works perfectly fine.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
So sometimes, you know, the site doesn't restrict you from certain characters when it should. Yeah. A lot of sites restrict you from using certain characters when, if they're hashing it properly, it shouldn't matter.
Yeah.
And then in some cases, they...
Yeah, sometimes like the developer just... puts a limitation in there when they're writing the web app, and then for whatever reason. Yeah. And the other thing is you can modernize your back end where you support different types of passwords, but if you don't then refresh the front end to it, you know, right, Alan.
You know, get some JavaScript validation and it's in there and it's weird and whatever.
The next question comes in from Wilcock, who's in the chat room right now, and oh my gosh, I would hate to be in this position. So check this one out, and let's see if we can't help this guy out. He says, hey, Chris and Alan, so I have an ISP that annoyingly compresses the images sent to my computer through HTTP requests. I've gone around this in my browser by using a universal HTTP header modifier called Proximation, or Proximatron, whatever. It's old, but it's good. Okay. You know, and it uses no cache and cache control and stuff like that. However, this only applies to my browser, as you have to be able to redirect the HTTP request coming from the program through a local proxy server set up by the header modifier. I have other applications, such as Steam, that get data through HTTP that you can't set to run through a proxy server without then having to use SOCKs or proxy caps, and then having to have a whole bunch of horrible stack and software running just to get slightly better-looking images. So my question is this. Is there any easy way to modify outgoing incoming HTTP requests at an OS level so that it applies to the entire connection without having to run the aforementioned programs every time I boot up? I have an idea of maybe routing my connection through a VPS, and I have an HTTP filter. I have the HTTP filter on that. What do you guys think?
Right.
And stay cool.
So I got a little background of this from the chat room the other night. The thing is, basically, he's running his whole internet connection through the data plan on his phone.
It's Will Ock, not Will Cuck.
Yes. Anyway, so he's using his cell phone's like 3G or 4G internet connection for his home computer.
Uh-huh.
And so his ISP obviously has a transparent HTTP proxy that's compressing images to save data planning.
That would make me want to cut myself. I'd be so frustrated.
Well, if you're looking at the images on your phone, you probably don't even notice that they're doing it.
Well, okay.
But on your computer, yes. It's obviously causing problems.
My phone
right?
has the Retina display, Alan, actually? No, I don't know. I just sounded really funny.
But he's getting around it by adding some headers that cause the proxy server not to screw with it. What he could do is if you use something like OpenVPN on either each computer or a router that then talks to your phone, which you can run pfSense on or whatever. Anyway, if you use OpenVPN, you could route all the connections outbound through your VPS and then onto the internet from there, and they wouldn't be interfered with. So you wouldn't have to do any header bunging at all. So you wouldn't, you just by sending everything over the data connection encrypted with OpenVPN, your ISP is not going to be able to interfere with any of it.
So you can't think of any software locally to do it?
Well, the problem is that the transparent proxy that's doing the
taking place
changing
further up in the
stream is in front of him. So even if he had his own SQUID proxy,
it's happening before it gets to him.
Exactly. Now he could use a local SQUID proxy to add those headers.
That's what I was wondering.
To cause his ISP to stop doing that, but some of those headers are going to cause those images never to be cached, and so it's going to hurt his performance and use up his data plan faster?
Well, I mean, it's almost... Well, yeah, if he has a cap, that might be.
Which he possibly does. I'm not sure. But yeah.
I hope. I mean, I hope so that's why they're doing... Because if his ISP is compressing otherwise, that's atrocious.
Well, again, it's because this is for your phone. This isn't meant for you to be using your home computer off of it. He just is.
That silly guy.
Right? He's like tethering to his phone
as
his permanent internet connection.
Because it's so unlimited, he says. He's in the chat room right now. He said, well, yeah, it's an unlimited data plan. Of course I'm doing
it. Anyway, so if he uses the OpenVPN, OpenVPN can compress the data before it encrypts it. So you can any savings that might be there can still be realized.
Okay.
Although less important if you have unlimited, but can be still important if you have speed. Your 3G is not necessarily that fast. You can't really do HTTPS for everything because not every website supports HTTPS. Mm-hmm. And so the VPN is the easiest route. Simple app install on your computer, install the server on your VPS, and you're sorted. He already has a VPS, so that's an easier option.
Yeah.
You could just get VPN service without a VPS in some places, and so on. But, yeah, I wouldn't appreciate an ISP interfering with my stuff either.
No, and as somebody who puts, like, you know, the images for our shows out there, I specifically balance the file size with the way it looks. I try to make it look as sharp as possible, but be the smallest file size possible. Every single episode artwork, I work on that. So to have them just crap all over kind of pisses
especially
me off.
They're doing it as fast as possible to avoid
It's sloppy.
So it's sloppy and
Well, all right. So there's our emails. We had to bang through it because we got too much show here this week. But if you want to send us something, emails, techsnap@jupiterbroadcasting.com. Get your question in here, get your comments in here, or start a thread on our subreddit, and we'll try to get it answered on next week's episode of TechSnap, because we'd like to have a few questions every single week. But Alan, with all the emails done, that means it's time for the TechSnap Roundup. And
and welcome to the TechSnap Roundup. Yeah, that's what that crazy music means. Now, the Roundup are stories that didn't quite make it to the top of the show. I know, it seems like it should because it's so huge, but didn't make it. Yeah. We couldn't fit it. It's too much.
The top of the show couldn't have been any, but it was already bigger than it needed to be.
So. Well, I was already worried about getting a ticket for being too big. So we stuck the Roundup stories at the bottom half of the show. They're almost always submitted by our subreddit, and you can do so over at links.techsnap.tv. And we're going to try to blast through them as fast as possible, and you can find the links for follow-up to get to further reading on your own after the show.
Yes. If you want some homework, there's lots in here.
All right. Yeah. We got a big Roundup this week. All right, Alan. The first one, new malware variant, uses Google Docs as a proxy to phone home.
Yeah, so it appeared basically it writes data into Google Docs, and then the central server reads the data out of the Google Doc as a way to communicate.
Like, the malware has like a shared doc. They're like sharing a doc.
Yeah, and they're reading and writing to it like it's some kind of scratch pad or something.
All right. Well,
So the next story is Facebook is enabling HTTPS by default for all North American users. So they've had this for about 2 years where you can dig into the options and turn on HTTPS always.
Right.
But now it's going to be the default. So that means people sniffing your traffic and...
good example of how...
open Wi-Fi and so on. Something everything like, can be HTTPS.
Something like FireSheep comes along and it kicks a company's ass into gear like Facebook to actually turn... I mean, I'm not sure if it was the sole reason they did it, but I have a feeling... I mean, they started really moving on this after... Remember FireSheep is that Firefox extension that just sniffs the network traffic and then can just assemble somebody's entire Facebook session if they're not using SSL?
Right.
And yeah. All right, Alan, well, the next story. Oh, my God, everybody, freak out. A new Linux rootkit has emerged, and it's like none I've seen before.
This is actually a big deal, unlike the FreeBSD one.
No, just stick it at the bottom of the show. We don't need to talk about this. So this new rootkit is loaded in memory, and then once there, it pulls out some memory addresses and then stores them for use later. It also hooks into several kernel functions as a way to hide from some of the some of its files on the machine.
And so basically, it's targeted at web servers, and the way it was originally found is somebody running an Nginx web server noticed that his customers were being redirected to bad sites. And so he reconfigured his Nginx server to return a 400 error every time somebody went to this one domain and noticed that they were getting redirected still. So then he did some strace to watch what was happening, and found the problem wasn't with Nginx. Nginx was sending just the 400 error. But then by the time it would go over the internet, it would have this iframe embedded in it.
Ah.
And after some digging, he found this rootkit was injecting an iframe, directing users to sites full of spam and malware.
So the rootkit compromises the web server, which then installs an iframe on their website, which then infects the malware with the visiting user.
The web server as in the machine. So basically... the malware or the rootkit goes in the kernel.
All right.
And
the kernel's connected to the web server. Web server's connected to the web page. So, web page connected to an iframe. Yeah. And the iframe's loaded by the user.
So it's not actually a vulnerability in Nginx or Apache or Light HTTPD or whatever, but all of those will have this iframe injected in every page they return.
Yeah. And then what's funny is they would probably then spread Windows malware, so that way they can infect the visiting user. All right. Well, folks can go read that. We might have a little more of that in the Linux Action Show this week.
So next story. Thieves use an airport's own forklifts to steal $1.5 million worth of iPad minis. They just kind of walked into the airport, borrowed a fork truck, loaded pallets of them up on a truck, and left.
$1.5 million, that's significant. That's noticeable. Well, that's,
you know, iPad minis are kind of small but still expensive, so they're... you know, two pallets of them is quite a bit. And there's a related story from Network World about the Apple crime wave, which has just shown that, you know, a very large percent of all, like, petty thefts are cell phones and iPads.
Right, yeah.
And it's really adding up. And
I would think
that's
so.
That's why important, like we talked about a couple weeks ago, the cell phone carrier is making this blacklist so that when you report your phone stolen, the person who stole it can't activate that phone.
Yeah, yeah.
And so on.
All right, well, let's cover a story that got people worked up, including myself this week, but it's actually already been scuttled. So people might have heard that there was some work going on to make it possible for the U.S. government to read email, your direct Twitter messages, your private Facebook posts, and all of those things. It's just part of – just they're just doing a little adjustment to some security bills, and they're just going to sweep this one in there. And Senator Leahy was the one who sponsored this. He's actually, via tweet, now come out and said that he's not going to support any legislation that includes this ability for the U.S. government. But, you know, they just right there, Alan, it's just, they just slip it right in. And it was initially him. He slipped it in there.
And then he got such blowback from it once it became public that that they changed, they took it out. Now, here's the concerning part. Is he saying, well, this was just a draft. We didn't actually intend for the public to react to this. This is yet another example of why we need to bring these processes behind closed doors. So that way we don't upset the public before it's really going to, before anything's going to shape out from it. So you guys overreacted.
When they do that, it's going to be, oh, sorry, you're too late.
Yeah. Well, in fact, to that point, Obama has classified a directive that he has signed, the cybersecurity directive, that essentially is some fundamental changes for the way the U.S. government's going to handle cybersecurity threats. And we can't see it. Hands off. We're not allowed to see what it is. And this is, they're just going to do more and more of this stuff. You look at this. It's that close, Alan. That close. They may. And why does this stuff slip in there constantly? It's just so aggravating. Yep. And I don't know why email has to be treated like email should be treated like we treat the U.S. mail. You know, that they should have the same private Fourth Amendment rights. So anyways, but if you got yourself all worked up about that this week, so for now, you can relax over the Thanksgiving holiday. You don't have to freak out. You Canadians and other people in the world, you never had to worry in the first place. You have other problems, though, you have to worry about.
Right.
All right.
The U.S. doesn't have any compunctions about spying on my email.
No, no. We have apparently...
I'm a foreign enemy.
We have legal right, apparently, to do that. So
anyway,
you can almost guarantee that's happening.
Next story. I link here for a post about a couple of different legal experts and debating the legality of cyber or counter-hacking or hackback.
Ah.
So basically, if someone's hacking into your server and you find out what their control server is and take it over, are you committing an illegal act?
Right. I mean, you got to wonder, like, if you somehow caught somebody doing it live, active, you kind of want to go after them too, right?
Right, and so they're talking about whether it's legal to do that or not.
Yeah. All right, well, this one's kind of funny. We saw the chat room talking about this earlier. Microsoft accidentally gifts pirates with a free Windows 8 license key.
Yeah, so basically, if you go to their website, I think until January 31st, they were giving away free keys for the Media Center Pack.
Right.
Which is just the codec to play DVDs and stuff, I think. But it turns out that you can use that to actually activate a Windows 8 developer or consumer preview as Windows 8 Pro.
Yeah.
For free.
Yeah, they must just be like overriding the activation subsystem or something.
I don't know if it's actually pirates actually have like a crack for the Windows key management system and they're using it that way or what, but
oh, this is funny. Yeah, so it's a key that's actually pre-activated. It's called a KMS activated copy of Windows 8, which is you can get that in a lot of different scenarios. You enter that key in and the key is already pre-activated. That's what it is. So they must have known they were doing this then, because they're the ones that issued pre-activated keys. Maybe they just didn't think about it.
Right, but they probably didn't think that people could use the Media Center key to get Windows 8 for free.
It'll be a cold day in hell, I guess, when they get rid of that activation stuff. All right, Alan, should we talk about the jail that looms for a man who revealed the AT&T leaked iPad user emails? I remember that story.
Yes.
That
so, yeah,
me.
We covered the story a while ago, and it started before the show, but we talked about a bit about it, I think.
Well, because mine was one of them that was leaked.
Yeah, so AT&T had that leak of customers' iPad information. And the guy who originally reported that has been charged and actually was found guilty yesterday of crimes under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for unauthorized access to that leaked material. Now, as far as I'm aware, that material was accidentally published on AT&T's website. And so saying, and then he accessed it from there. So saying that was unauthorized access might be pushing it. It's
right.
Like,
it
sure,
was,
AT&T didn't say
it was URL,
you can access.
It was hidden. It was like the URL is hidden. So if you could figure out what the URL was, you could go see it, is what it was.
Right, but he didn't. He must have found it somehow.
Yeah, well, it wasn't too hard to figure out.
Right.
So,
it comes down to if AT&T made it public but didn't give you access to didn't authorize you to access it, is it still illegal to look at it? It's like, well, if it was on the internet and I didn't have to break in to get it, then they can't really be unauthorized access. It seems like that
silly
case needs to be looked at, and that guy shouldn't have been found guilty, most likely.
It's probably a hard thing for the legal system to understand the nuance there.
Well, it's more importantly probably a hard thing for a judge that doesn't know anything about the internet to understand.
Yeah. Alan, flash update from our last story. See in the chat room says it's activated, but you need a KMS activation server to finish the activation. Now, I happen to know that one
but
of the ways
pirate people have cracked the KMS activation.
Yes, that's if you. That's yes. I'll just leave it at that. All right. The next story in the roundup pisses me off as a Usenet user and a PayPal user. Here's another PayPal story. PayPal bans Usenet providers over piracy concerns. So you can't pay for your Usenet anymore with PayPal. It pisses me off because it's actually how I've been paying for my Usenet. So I wonder if my existing subscription...
although is anybody paying for Usenet from a private provider for any reason other than piracy?
I download Linux ISOs that way. And
I'm sure.
Other things? I don't know. All right, fine. Yeah. Fine. So you're saying they should do this?
No, but it is... It's actually against their published terms of service, so.
Yeah.
The question is are VPNs next?
Oh, yeah, because I guess they probably could use the same justification or bypassing
VPNs,
copyright.
It's easier to justify a VPN.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah, you're right. Usenet is a little harder. I could say it's just for good discussion, but I don't think they'd believe me.
Right.
All right, Al, next story in the roundup. Hosting provider... Antagonist automatically fixes vulnerabilities in customers' websites.
Right. So the Dutch provider Antagonist.nl developed an application that automatically patches a customer's WordPress, Drupal, or Joomla if the customer doesn't patch it within 2 weeks of the notice from their ISP saying it's vulnerable. Now, I don't know if this is just patching it or if they do a complete upgrade on the WordPress, because that has great potential to break things. Like, I understand people need to upgrade their WordPress as quickly as possible, but some large sites are slow for a reason.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, like, you're waiting for a plugin to be updated to be compatible with a new version and so on.
Yep.
So I don't know if it's always a good thing to have this ISP automatically upgrading your thing. Although, as a web hosting provider, I'm all for this because I don't like it when my customers get hacked and they complain at me and it's like, well, it's your fault you didn't upgrade your WordPress.
WordPress really needs to come up with a way to accommodate this because they just push out
many
updates.
Well, they need to make sure they don't break things between updates. Right? Well, updates never break anything and then you'll be okay.
Well, I guess so. All right. Should we cover this last story?
The other thing is they're going to license the technology so other web hosting providers could buy it.
Oh, well, wouldn't that be interesting? It seems, okay. Wouldn't that be interesting if that's how they end up making a lot of their revenue? All right, Alan. The last story in the roundup for this week. A battery-powered transmitter could crash a city's 4G network, according to this article over that we found on Slashdot.
Yes. So basically, it costs about $600, and you hook it up to a laptop, and apparently you can make a hell of a mess with it. I don't know all the details, but if you're interested in knowing how you could crash the whole 4G network, the link's there and go read it. That's the whole point of the roundup.
Yeah, I mean, the scary thing is it affects LTE. It's battery powered, and they're saying in 5 to 10 years, these would be super easy for people to come up with. They're also saying it could be a possible terrorist attack vector. So you got to watch out for that. Terrorists might take down a cell network before they, cause a ruckus. So, all right.
Well, there's that, but I could also see less than open government regimes. Like we've seen in the Middle East and so on, that they're using cell phones and Twitter and so on to organize demonstrations. So if you could just shut down the cell network in an area with one of these devices, you could possibly prevent some of that. Although in some cases, the government controls the phone company, and so they could just turn all phone service off. But
yeah, and actually, some local municipal transportation department in San Francisco. Something that was happening, and they turned on cell jamming for all of the passengers,
Yes, I remember. I think we talked about that a little bit.
Yeah. So we've actually seen the in a local capacity, we've seen a U.S. local government actually use technology like this and just screws up everybody's phones. So I wouldn't be surprised. Everybody's going to use it. Even pranksters will use it. That's the way technology works. All right, Alan. Well, there you go. That's the whole show, isn't it?
Yep.
That's the whole show. Now, if you want to watch us live, we're almost always live on Thursdays, unless there's a special holiday like this week, at 1 p.m. Pacific, which is... That's your cue.
Oh, Right. 4 p.m. Eastern, 2100 UTC.
I've only done that like 85 times, so I don't know.
Yeah, sorry. I was looking at titles for the episode and not listening to you.
Oh, you're already voting. So people who watch live, that's one of the reasons to watch live, is you can suggest titles as we go. They get voted up at the end of the show. We have a voting system, and then that usually is what becomes the title of the episode. So that's where those come from. And you can do that just by joining us at jblive.tv or jblive.info and signing into our chat room as the show goes. All right, Alan. Well, thank you, sir, for the great show. And thank you, everyone, for tuning into this week's episode of TechSnap. I want to say happy birthday to my wife, Angela, who I probably shouldn't say how old she turned, but she's not 30 quite yet. Quite yet. Just missed it by that much. Today's her birthday. So happy birthday, Angela. And thank you. And thank you to everybody who tunes in this week. I know Thanksgiving week is traditionally not a huge download week for us, but those of us who do download the show, I'm sure, appreciate it a little extra more. So hopefully you had a great Thanksgiving holiday if you celebrate it. And if not, hopefully you just enjoyed all the obnoxious Americans being offline for a day. The internet's yours for like one day. So there you go. That's at least you get that. That's something to be thankful for. All right, everyone. Well, thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of TechSnap, and we'll see you right back here next week.